Thank you for that introduction. Am I allowed to say thank you, Grandpa? You got a crew in the back. I see a couple of smiles from the back of the room. Yes, I am allowed to say that apparently. And yes, it got dark suddenly. So it may be not just my booming voice that you hear here in a little bit. You know, it's interesting, and we say this very often when we speak, there is nothing new under the sun. And this book that we read from, that we hold in our laps, was written so many generations ago. And yet, the men that get up and speak, and sometimes when we're speaking to anyone, it's not just the men, but when we're speaking to the brethren, you know, we hear a different point of view, a different angle, a different idea. And our receptionist has one of those easy buttons at the office. But I have to say that when I see that in the office, I've never quite thought of it that way. And when I see it on Monday, I will now think of that differently as I see it. So I thank Mr. Kester for that particular message because, you know, we think about it, yeah, that, oh, that project that I've got, where's that easy button? But there's other aspects of our lives that we don't often think about. So literally, when we hear messages, so often what we hear is the same thing given with a different example or from a different point of view or saying, I've never thought of it that way. So very effective way. And one other thing I wanted to mention before we got going, Mr. Seeker talked about this Far East satellite television and the fact that it has a potential audience of 4.3 billion people. I'm reading the announcement that came out last week. But what was interesting as it finishes that, it says that 4.3 billion people equals approximately 60% of the world's population. So, you know, as we've talked about the fact, you know, the gospel must be preached into all the world and then can and will the end come. We look at the fact that, you know, how is it that over time the door has been shut and you can't get into communist Russia and you can't get into communist China and you can't get into the Muslim-speaking countries? Well, if just the few bodies in that area that God intends to hear it satisfy one more leg of that requirement, how exciting is that, that literally 60% now in certain areas of the country can this particular message can be preached. And we're not the only one preaching that gospel. We know that too. But when numbers like 4.3 billion didn't resonate with me, but 60% of the world population, that kind of creates a little different mental picture. And sometimes that's what it's all about, like the easy button, helping us to see and just something else about this day or this week, that easy button, we're going to close our eyes and the smile is going to come to our face. And that's effective in helping us to continue this battle, to continue this walk. In 1973, a film came out that was based on a best-selling French autobiography. The name of the movie was Papillon, and it was based on the French convict Henri Carrier. The film starred Steve McQueen and Dustin Hoffman, and the film's title is French, and in English it means butterfly, and that represents the tattoo that was on the main character's chest, and it became his nickname as well. He became known as Papillon, or actually in the movie he'd be called Pappy. Now, Henri, who was played by Steve McQueen, is a petty criminal who was unjustly convicted of murder in 1930s France. And what happened to major criminals back in 1930s France was that they were sentenced to a life imprisonment in the notorious French penal colony on Devil's Island off the coast of French Guiana. Now, in the movie and in the book as well, en route, Henri meets a fellow convict. His name is Louis Degas, and that's played by Dustin Hoffman, and they develop a friendship as the movie progresses. Now, after defending Degas, it turns out that Degas was in trouble for a number of other things, So he was kind of the brains. He was, you know, real thick glasses and that type of thing. He'd been in trouble for embezzling and things like that. But Steve McQueen played the tough guy and had come to the defense against a sadistic guard. And because of that, Papillon was sentenced to solitary confinement. In gratitude, as he's in solitary confinement, Degas managed to smuggle extra food into his daily rations. Matter of fact, what he smuggles him is a half a coconut. Because by chewing on the coconut, he gets the fiber, he gets the vitamins and that type of thing that he'll need to help him get through this period of solitary confinement. Ultimately, though, the food smuggling is discovered. The prison guards cut Papillon's food rations in half, with the expectation that hunger will force him to reveal the name of his benefactor. And though he becomes emaciated and half insane, and actually you see in the movie that he's killing the roaches and eating the bugs in order to give him some additional sustenance, he does not snitch on Degas. And when he is ultimately released from solitary confinement after 2 years, including 6 months on half rations and in total darkness, he's reunited with Degas, and they soon begin planning their escape from this Devil's Island. During the short time of Papillon's rehabilitation, after he was released from his solitary confinement, Degas, who now is reunited with him and is helping him rehabilitate, asks why he didn't give his name away in order to shorten his punishment. And Papillon says to him, "There was a point where I was really tempted." And for impact, he hesitates there in the movie. And Dustin Hoffman, playing Luis Degas, he hangs his head and he shakes his head out of inspiration, wonderment, really, I think, at what this guy must have gone through. And he states the following. He said, "Temptation resisted is a true measure of character." Temptation resisted is a true measure of character. Today in the sermon, I'd like to talk more about this concept of character and where it comes to play and how we see it played out in lives around the world. And certainly, you know, Mr. Kester turned to the book of Hebrews, and it talked about those that withstood great trials, and their faith was strong enough to carry them through. But what stood under that faith? What developed along with that faith through the lives of those Christian heroes? And we would have to say that it was the character. It was the strength of will that they got from their faith and dependence in the promises of God looking forward. First of all, brethren, let's explain a little bit about what character is. And here comes that thundering voice. I just saw a flash of light. So if the lights go down, I'll just have to speak a little louder. Definition of character, and there are several of them, but it says that there are attributes or features that make up and distinguish an individual. So when we look at someone and we look at how they carry themselves, we look at how they react under pressure, and we can see the character, we can see the qualities that distinguish that individual in a situation. It also refers to the complex mental or ethical traits marking and often individualizing a person, and by extension, a group, or even a nation. So as we can see the qualities that make up an individual and make them respectable and strong in any given situation, we can see that same type of thing is attributed to the ethics and the morals that those people carry. That's the grist on which that character gets built. It also refers to a moral excellence and firmness. Character is often something that is described as backbone. You know, the person has a spine. They're capable of standing up under pressure. Christ, who spent a lifetime on this ball that we call earth, understood these things. He felt the pressure. He faced the temptations. He heard the murmurings. He felt the pain. And he recognized that those that would seek to follow him, those that would read the situation and whose minds would be open to say there is a greater future, and it may not be easy at any given moment, but the reward of that is incredible. And those people that live and seek to live that life will feel those same temptations, feel those same pressures, and need to have that same spine, that same strength of character to carry them through and to set the example for others that need to see that example set so that they can walk in that same path. Christ first recognized that fact in the book of John. You can write down or turn with me to John chapter 17 and verse 14. John chapter 17 and verse 14. We'll read a couple of verses here. And here he's praying to the Father, and he says, "I have given them, my disciples, those that you have called, those whose eyes and minds and hearts you have opened, I have given them your word." John chapter 17 and verse 14. "I have given them your word, and the world has hated them, because they are not of the world." The world has its own tune to which it dances, its own path on which it travels. And they're going to try to say, "Wait a minute, I'm
I'm uncomfortable with you setting a higher standard. You make me look bad. You make me feel bad. I want the easy way, Satan's easier way, and therefore I don't like you because you don't espouse my lifestyle. You don't approve of how I live. And so it says, the world has hated them because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Now notice what he says in verse 15. I do not pray that you would take them out of this world. And so Satan recognizes that the challenges that will come, the angst created between the rest of the world and his followers will be real. But he says, I pray not that you take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one. And so he has promised that if you will climb under my edge of this yoke, that path is easier. When you look at the complete picture, that path is easier. Because you don't have to watch over your shoulder, because what you did was outside proper bounds. But it said, I pray that you should keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of this world. Sanctify them by your truth. Set them apart. Watch over them. Give them the strength and the protection that they will need, because your word is truth. So sanctify them by your truth. By that instruction, by that education, by that clarity, give them the strength, the backbone that they need to carry on in my name. Christ knew that this world, with both its beauty and its ugliness, would push in on the lives of future Christians. He knew that we would sometimes find ourselves neck deep in the pressures and the temptations of this world. Some of them are very minute. Some of them are rather easy. And sometimes it's the easiest ones that are easy to slide into. You know, you're not looking down the sight of a gun and looking to kill someone, but the little white lie and the things like that, all these are temptations to step away from the character, away from the backbone that we know we ought to have, the example that was set for us in the Word, which we know is truth. How strong are we, brethren, when the heat is on, when we wake up to find ourselves smack dab in the middle of life, and that life is pointed or being dragged and pulled in one particular direction that we know is not right? We have an obligation, brethren, as God's children, to stand our ground each and every day to show that true measure of character. And that includes things like, we know, telling the truth, standing for what is right, standing in defense of someone when somebody else is doing something inappropriate, keeping our promises, being on time, being a person that's dependable. There are qualities that we see and that we appreciate in others and that we know are right. And this world likes it when they work on their behalf. But so few of them are willing to stand in the gap when it becomes uncomfortable. And so we have to set that example and live at that higher standard according to those universal principles. We see every day that this concept of right and wrong is under constant attack. And what was once a generally accepted code of conduct, you know, just a few generations ago, people did indeed lay down their lives for other people. People went out of their way to help others. And yet it seems that it's a glorious opportunity when we see it nowadays, because it happens much less often. When we look between the covers of the Bible, we see that human beings have lost the game early in the book of Genesis and have generally lived below the standard ever since. And yes, that's a broad brush statement to some degree, but if we were to look at the balance, if we look at the human constant, we would see that the ledger is very heavily weighted on Satan's behalf. And we heard that in the sermonette as well. One of the greatest problems that we face today is that too many people live their lives according to situational ethics. And we know by definition and by extension that in the lives around us, situational ethics say, well, I build my decisions, the ethics, the principles, my character is built on the moment. And so if I can, it says that outgoing concern and brotherly love. So if I can somehow say that at least part of what I'm doing is based on my concern for someone else, well, then I can justify what I'm doing. We know that God's law is not arbitrary. We know that it's not to be applied sometimes. God gave it to us as a guide to happy and healthy life. And when we break those commandments, we will face consequences. God's law is absolute and binding in our lives, and we know it is that universal set of principles, values, and beliefs that the majority of mankind is lost without, struggles to find, appreciates when they see, but still struggles to live by. Psalm chapter 119 and verse 165. That's a lot to write down in and of itself. Psalm chapter 119, verse 165. It says, "Great peace have they which love thy law, and nothing shall offend them." We heard in the We heard in the sermonette, the first message today, about stumbling blocks. And what this, it says, nothing shall offend them. And the Hebrew really refers to they shall have no stumbling block. You know what it's like to fumble around in the dark, which we may end up with shortly. But, you know, in the middle of the night, you're getting up and you need a drink or something like that. And maybe you don't put your glasses on and it's dark. And you're kind of fumbling around. You're feeling for the edge of that coffee table because, you know, when that little pinky toe hits that, it's not going to be a happy time. So on a physical plane, you've probably done that. You know, I see a few heads nodding out there, and you say, oh, man, those things are so sensitive and so timid that sometimes you kind of curl them under and you're walking very carefully. On a physical plane, we can relate to that because we understand that to walk astray can be painful. But that stumbling block also refers to a higher level from a spiritual standpoint. We're talking here about ethics and morals and principle and backbone and the ability to stand in a tough situation. Do we have that true test of character? So if there is no universal code, or better put maybe, if the universal code that's currently being used by those around us is not up to par, how do we swim against the current? How do we battle the peer pressure? We talked about temptation, and often that's what it is. This world is trying to get us to change our color, change our stripes, relax ourselves down to their level so that they don't feel less than up to par. How do we battle that peer pressure? How do we sidestep the temptation? And would our neighbors be inspired by our character the way Louis Degas appreciated what Papillon did for him? To keep ourselves unstained by the lawlessness of this world, we need to have that strong background, that strength of character. Let's look at a few scriptures that make that point for us. First of all, 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 17. That'll help the lawns a little bit. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 17. We'll read a number of verses here. And it tells us to come out of this world. It tells us, again, that there is a rule book by which we are to live. And that is contrary or disengaged from what the world around us uses. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 17, it says, "Therefore come out from among them and be separated." You know, Christ said, do not take them out. Do not physically separate them. We know that we weren't whisked away to some Shangri-La. But we know that spiritually speaking, we have to come out from among them and be separated, says the Lord, "and do not touch the unclean thing, and I will receive you." If you will live this way, if you will do this, which is going to require some effort on your part, some backbone, some spine, if you will do this, then it says at the end of 17 and into verse 18, it says, "And I will receive you," verse 18, "and I will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty." So those people that say, come, walk with us, do it this way, you can be a member of our club, and you can have the benefits of our conversation and our membership. I'd much rather have the membership where God is the chairman of that organization and the benefits that are permanent and coming soon, we pray. We can hear that same admonition in the book of Revelation, in Revelation chapter 18 and verse 4. Revelation chapter 18 and verse 4, it says again, "Come out of her, my people, that you may not be partakers of her sin." I said earlier that when we break that constant and unbending law of God, when we choose to know that truth and at least for the moment step away from it, we will pay a consequence. But in Revelation 18:4, it says, "Come out of her." That means stay true with that spine and that backbone. Stay true to my teachings, my people, that you may not be partakers of her sins, and that you may not receive of her plagues, that you may not bear the consequence of the activity that I find unacceptable. The world around us can be an alluring place, you know, to chase the success, the prosperity, the notoriety, the publicity that's within reach. Satan wraps it up and makes it rather enticing. He excites our senses and he feeds on our desires. But our character, remember, if we get back to the definition, our character or those attributes or features that make up and distinguish us as God's children must be rock solid. Let's look at some further admonition about how we need to guard our thoughts and our actions and the things that we choose to do and to be involved in. Let's go to the book of Proverbs. There's so much given in the book of Proverbs, you know, written as a father to a son, saying, son or young man, don't go there. The world has done it, and the world pays its price. Your life can be properly hooked under my yoke and walking down my road alongside me. And as it said, take this opportunity to learn, because while we're shoulder to shoulder pulling in the same direction, you have added capacity because you absorb some from me. But if you step out from under that, there's a lot of trails out there that can get you in trouble. Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 10. Several verses here from Proverbs chapter 1, beginning in verse 10. My son, if sinners lure you, do not be willing. Again, sinners are out there luring. Satan the devil makes it enticing. You know, he's gonna dangle a carrot. Sooner or later in our lives, he's gonna dangle a carrot in front of us that catches our interest. The question is, do we have the strength to say no? And if we haven't in the past, from the time that we spend here studying this and educating ourselves and growing stronger, do we have the strength ready for next time? My son, if sinners lure you, do not be willing. Verse 11, if they say, come with us, let us lie in wait for blood. Now, they're not generally going to say it that way, because that'll turn some people off. Again, they're crafty in how they put it. They're going to say, you know, come on, come hang with us. There's lots of opportunity. And if you're a little squeamish, they're going to put it a little bit lighter and get you to cast in your lot. If they say, come with us, let us lie in wait for blood. Verse 13, we shall find all precious goods. You know, their houses are full of all kinds of baubles, all kinds of toys to play with, all kinds of rich and exciting and enjoyable things. We shall find all precious goods. We shall fill our houses with plunder. Verse 14, again, cast in your lot among us. Verse 15, my son, do not walk in the way with them. Keep back your foot from their path. Have the strength to say no, to recognize that that's a dangerous place to be. Verse 16, for their feet run to evil and make haste to shed blood. They destroy the lives around them. If it's not physically, they do it emotionally, they do it economically, they do it socially sometimes to get what they want or to hurt those that they don't want. And verse 18, they lie in wait for their own blood. In the end, what God is saying is that they will have that consequence that comes from breaking my law. They may get away with it for now, but in the long run, they're going to be far from the opportunities and the promises that I've made. We know that the ways of righteousness bring with them riches and honor and peace, the easy life, not always, but a life where you can go to bed and sleep with what you've done today. A life that you don't always have to keep a ledger of what story you told to which person to make sure that you tell them the same story the next time so that you don't get caught in that circle. The ways of this world are not the ways of God, and the end result of this world's way of life will not bring the blessings of God. They wait and lie in wait for their own end. A few more parallel verses, still in the book of Proverbs, verse 23 here. Proverbs chapter 23 and verse 17. Do not let your heart envy sinners, but be in the fear of the Lord all the day. So again, do not dwell on, oh, I wish I had what they have, but instead what I want is that long-term vision, those perpetual, those permanent blessings that come both in this life, but certainly in a future life as well. Proverbs 23:17. Proverbs chapter 24, verses 1 and 2. Proverbs chapter 24 and verse 1, do not be envious of evil men. They have what they have, and they got it by their methods. Sometimes it's hard work. It didn't all come from surreptitious methods. But it says, do not be envious of evil men, nor desire to be with them, for their heart devises violence, and their lips talk of troublemaking. The things that they can get easy, they'll take. The things that they want, they'll do whatever they need to do to get them. And so when we walk according to those ways, we soon go astray of God's truth. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 11. Again, a number of verses
that talk about the way we're supposed to live and what we're supposed to avoid. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 11. It says, "Have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them." You know, we know that the truth is light, and we know that dark cannot abide light. It is by the introduction of light that darkness is banished. Darkness cannot force light out. It works exactly the opposite. So it says to avoid those ways of darkness and those people that live according to that way, but rather reprove them. Keep those at arm's distance. Let them know that you don't approve and will not commiserate with them. James chapter 4 and verse 7. Again, a number of these scriptures. It says, "Therefore, submit yourselves to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you." That same concept of you have light and you have darkness. You have good and you have evil. And in the presence of good and in the presence of light, darkness and evil cannot abide. And so if we'll keep that in our mind and recognize that in a way, that's one of the easy buttons that we talked about. We've got a decision to make here. We've got a temptation that's made, and we've got the truth as we know it. And sometimes what we need is just that physical picture in our mind or that mental picture and that physical easy button and say, "I want easy in the long run. I do not choose this way because it will bring heartache." Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 10 and 11. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 10, it says, "Finally, my brothers," you know, finally doesn't only mean the last thing, as in, okay, this is my last or final breath, but in the final summation, in what the true and whole story is, finally, when we wrap this all together and we look at it from a truthful standpoint, "Finally, my brothers, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might." He has that button, and we have access to it when we drop to our knees and come before his throne. We tap into the power that that button has. Sorry, Mr. Kester, I'm going to wear that button out before I'm done here today. "My brothers, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might." Verse 11, "Put on the whole armor of God so that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil." Remember, we talked about standing, backbone, straight. In the face of challenge, we stand with a spine and with a commitment and with a structure and with a leverage that we need from God's training and God's truth. These passages and many more we could turn to show us the need to guard against that natural exhilaration of the world around us. Remember who runs this program, and it's the mastermind of marketing and temptation. You know, it's the clothes we can wear, it's the cars we can drive, it's the house we can be, it's the corner office that we might look for. But what do we need to get there? And are we willing to do what it takes to get there? Let God bless us into the position that he holds for us, instead of us taking the reins and then working with the world and through their program in order to get what we might want, what they hold up as the trophy. The scriptures warn us very strongly because we feel that pull. It's natural. There's human nature within us and an appreciation for those things that look and feel and smell and taste nice. Again, somewhere along the line, that carrot's going to be dangled in front of us. That's going to get us to think about, and we need to stand strong at that time. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 33 warns us again about the company we keep and how it is that we let that impact those ethics, those morals, those principles that show the individual that we are. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 33, something you've all heard many times before, it says, "Do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits." So when we walk in the presence of, when we hang with people, when we appreciate what they have, you know, Satan took Christ after his fasting. He took him up to the mountain. He said, look, he was trying to package things in a way that would tempt him to turn away, to weaken the strength of that spine and that shoulders and that character and that strength that was there, that spirit that was there, that faith that had been developed. Evil company corrupts good habits. Let's turn to a passage in Psalms where David addresses his issue, this issue of living God's way and the benefits of it. Psalm chapter 26. Psalm chapter 26, and again, we'll read the early part of this chapter. Psalm chapter 26, beginning in verse 1.
David writes here, "Vindicate me, O Lord, for I have walked in my integrity, my character." Now, you have to be careful anytime you use the word my, because that can cause the chest to puff out, not because of the strength of character that straightens that spine, but the pride that puffs out that chest and makes it look sometimes in a similar way. But it says, he has said, "I have walked in my integrity," and we'll see that flavored with God's strength in a moment. "I have also trusted in the Lord." So literally in his next statement, he says that, you know, my integrity has been crafted. My character has been strengthened and developed through my trust in you, God. And it says, "I shall not slip." In the commentary, that "I shall not slip" says, "I shall be preserved from swerving from the paths of righteousness and truth." So again, if I stay under that yoke, if I stay within the guidelines of the instructions and the rules by which I'm supposed to live, we're preserved from swerving. Verse number 2, it says, "Examine me, O Lord, and prove me. Try my mind and my heart." What did it say earlier? My morals, my ethics, is the character. It's what individualizes me and distinguishes me as one of God's children. Try my mind and my heart. Verse 3, it says, "I have walked in your truth." Verse 4 says, I have not sat with idolatrous mortals. And so we saw in Proverbs where it says, "My son, don't go this way. Don't be in their company. Don't chase their end." And David said, "I have not sat with idolatrous mortals, nor will I go in with hypocrites." So I choose the company because I know the wrong company can be very enticing. Verse 5, "I have hated the assembly of evildoers, and I will not sit with the wicked." Again, those baubles, those excitement, those temptations that are brought on by this world around us. Jumping down to verse 8, it says, "Lord, I have loved the habitation of your house. I have stayed away from their residence, but I love yours." I recognize that that's truly where quality comes, character comes, faith is built, and a long-term promise can come true. "I have loved the habitation of your house and the place where your glory dwells." Verse 11, "But as for me, I will walk in," again, it says my integrity, but it says that integrity has come through the years of living your way, Father, within your house, your habitation. "Redeem me and be merciful to me." Verse 12, "My foot stands in an even place." Again, we talked about "my foot shall not slip. Those shall not be offended or have a stumbling block in front of them." "My foot stands in an even place," and the commentary here says, "free from the occasions of stumbling," or a safe path. Again, when we're walking, even if it's brightly lit, but we're distracted or we've got something to do or we can't always see what's coming underfoot, God promises, and David writes the story for us, telling us that his foot, and by extension ours, can stand in an even place when it stands in the congregations of God. And it says, "In those congregations, I will bless the Lord." So David recognizes where his structure needs to be, where his foundation needs to be, and where he needs to help those around him as well, the congregations, to be blessed and to hear these stories and to see that example and to develop the strength of their own spine as well. Remember, we're asking the question here, temptation resisted is a true measure of character. We need to watch our steps and guard our thoughts and decisions from being corrupted, tainted, and stained by this world, brethren. We could look at the example of Joseph and how he resisted the advances of Potiphar's wife. You know, Joseph had been blessed. He had a real position of notoriety. And yet when the rubber met the road, when the true pressure came on, he knew that he needed to, you know, get his footing and then beat it. And we saw that he had the strength of character to resist that temptation and certain benefits that it may have brought for the short term in order to make sure that he was still working according to the rules that God had laid down for him. We could also turn to the book of 1 Samuel and look at another story in the life of David. We've already quoted from him. God had declared David to be Israel's next king. And even though he knew that, and think about it, from a human standpoint, we look at it and say, okay, I've been appointed. I am the soon-to-be king. Life should be good. And yet he was a hunted man, one that had to live out of caves, the one that had to scramble for his food and try to coordinate a place to sleep for the band that was with him. It was not an easy life. And when he had the opportunity in that cave to bring that comfort and that glory maybe a little bit sooner, he held his hand back because he knew that it wasn't the way that God would have put. That was an opportunity. It was a temptation to take things into his own control. And he said, no. As he said earlier, he said, I live my life according to your way. I listen to your law. I walk on your path. And Father, you have told me what the end soon will be, and I'm leaving that in your hands. He showed restraint and waited for God to handle things in his time. Today, I'd like to look at the story of Daniel as our study. We're talking about the character, and we're talking about the strength, and we're talking about the resisting of temptation, and we're talking about this world around us wanting to charge in on who we are and get us to let down our guard a little bit. And we can look at the story of Daniel and recognize that he was a godly man in an ungodly world. And as we look at our lives, we're striving to be godly men and women in an ungodly world around us. And so as we approach that each day, we need to make sure that we work toward that end. First of all, it's good for us to get the perspective that Daniel faced. You know, we can talk about our lives and the difficulties and the temptations that come. Last night, I was talking to some of you before service to start. Last night, my air conditioner died, and I came home from work to a little higher temperature than I would have expected walking through the door. And, you know, as I called the service guy and said, okay, it's only a couple of years old. What can you do for me? A Friday afternoon, I realized that. And the hottest day, so far this year in Buffalo. And he joked about the fact, I said, well, you know, you're here in the neighborhood. It's covered under warranty. I'd like you to get here if you can. And I said, you know, I've got family in, and I've got four youngsters, and I'd rather have them in the comfortable environment that we're expecting. And he kind of laughed, and he goes, you know, I grew up without air conditioning. And I says, yes, so did I. But I choose not to if I don't have to. So there's one of the short-term trials I had because I was going to glow a little bit during the evening. He came out, and he wasn't able to fix it. And so we made do with all the fans that we could in the open windows. And finally, about 2 o'clock in the morning, it got down to the point where I could fall asleep. Okay, fine. But is that one of the trials? Is that one of the temptations? When we look at the life of Daniel, we have to get a perspective of the fact that he did live without air conditioning, but that wasn't the extent of his trial. When we look at the servants of God and we look at the stories that are given to us, true temptation, true trial, pain, sometimes death, and we say that they stood strong through that. Again, as we look back to the book of Hebrews, do we have the strength to stand in the little trials we face, let alone the serious ones that have been a part of some of the servants of God? We know that Daniel was bombarded by Satan, and sometimes, again, we see it in a little point, but when we look at the heroes of the Bible, we recognize that Daniel's life was one of stark contrast. You know, when life was good for Daniel, he had it easy. Sorry. He had it smooth. You know what? He had a position that was recognized. He had a position that was blessed. He had great power and impact. And yet when he got to his low points, he was scraping the bottom of the barrel. Imagine being hauled into captivity and dragged away to some foreign land and facing an uncertain future as a young man. Once there, Daniel faced a challenge to his identity, his character, his religion, everything that he had come to know and understand, everything that made up the character and the backbone that was called Daniel. And I'm going to apologize right now because I find myself using Daniel and David sometimes interchangeably here. So if I do through this message, we're talking about Daniel through much or most of the rest. But if I speak too quickly and say David, forgive me. We're told that Scripture is written for our training and understanding, and really as a mirror or a measuring post which we hold ourselves up against. And so sometimes, always really, when we read through the passages, we read through these Scriptures, we read through the lives of these heroes, we have to recognize that we're not fighting lions in the Colosseum. And yet as a measuring post, when we look at the character, when we look at the integrity, when we look at the morals, when we look at the backbone, we have to ask ourselves, although our challenges may not stack up on a purely physical level, but do we, to some degree, to the degree necessary, do we show the same qualities? Can we stand up? Because God is saying, you know what? To whom little is given, little is expected. To whom much is given, much is expected. And when I see you stand up in these small things, I know that you're developing the character. You're growing and walking with me down the right path. And there will come a time when you will have a greater challenge. And he has the faith in us that our faith and character will be strong enough at that time to stand up. One of the first trials that Daniel faced in his life was a challenge to his identity. Again, if we go to Daniel chapter 1, and if we read from the beginning, we see early in the chapter that Nebuchadnezzar had conquered Jerusalem, and he had brought many of these bright young people with him back to Babylon, back to his hierarchy, back to his headquarters. And it says in Daniel 1 and verse 6, it says, among them were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. So again, these young people, you know, their place of life was conquered, and they were hauled off to a different city, a different kingdom in which they were going to live, and they didn't know what their future held for them. And it says in verse 7, and the chief of the eunuchs, who was that person in authority to affect the lives of these young people, it says he gave them names. And I mentioned, and we'll go into more detail about the fact that the character of who these people were, the very identity of who they were was starting to be chipped away at here. It was a process that they were going to use to convert these young people to their way of life. And it, so it says in verse 7, and the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. Again, it's important to understand that the Babylonians were beginning a process, and they weren't looking to break these young people. You know, very often we look at somebody being conquered and being taken into slavery, as the Israelites were in Egypt, and they were chained and they were put under bondage. They were put under great physical strain, but they weren't looking to do that. Effectively, they were looking to brainwash these young people and then use them as an asset in their society. And so they were looking really to convert them. And the first step was to chip away at Daniel's identity. You know, if you want to lose someone, if you want to hide someone, if you as the individual want to get lost, one of the things you do is you change the identity. You kind of cover up and you smoke screen the background so that people that are looking for the old don't find it anymore. The Hebrew name Daniel means God is my judge. And so every time Daniel heard his name, or when he was in school and he was writing his name, it was impressed upon him once again that God was a part of his life. God was actually a part of his name. It says, God is my judge. And so the name change was intended by those in Babylon to say, wait a minute, we're going to disconnect you from what you were, who you were, where you were, and how you lived your life. We're going to pull you into our culture. And we're going to disconnect. We're going to start cutting those strings that identify you with a prior life. They were looking to distance Daniel from his name, which had a degree of religious significance. The scripture doesn't provide us really what Daniel's reaction. It doesn't say that he stood up and screamed and threw a temper tantrum and said, I will not answer to this new name. But we have to recognize that it was a process that started with this particular physical thing. The next step in the process of converting these young people, again, it's more than just these four. They're who being focused on here, and we're looking at Daniel in particular, but was to pump them up full of the formal education that would have been part of the culture. Again, what they're looking to do is to distance them. Whatever you've been taught in the past, whatever you've been trained by and conditioned with in the past to become part of your character, we're looking to cover that up and to distance you from that. We can see in verses 3 and 4 that they were exposed to education, and it would have been of every type. We know that they would have been included language, and so they would have learned new words and new expressions and new slang. You know, so much of what our young people learn today is slang, which makes them cool and makes them part of a particular group. So you got to talk this way if you want to be with us, because that makes you part of the in crowd. They would have read the literature, would have pumped them full of the history of that culture and the heroes of that culture and what it was that you wanted to be like in order to be appreciated. The law and the history, the business, the theology, they would have been introduced to the multiple gods that were recognized in that particular area. They would have seen the arts and they would have had the greatest of music put before them. They would have been trained to be more like the culture they were to become a part of.
Again, we need to remember that these people, these young people were bright. They were leaders. They were seen as capable. The best of the best were taken back to the palace to be converted. They tried to change Daniel's way of thinking and the basis of his values so that he could be an asset to them. And what we're going to begin to see as we look further into Daniel's life is that there comes a point where, okay, it's not just style anymore. It's not just the name tag that you put on me. It's not just the hat I wear. Now you're trying to get into my head. Now you're trying to get into my heart. And where that character comes to play, Daniel begins to draw the line. Again, we have to measure ourselves according to the character that God's looking for. We have to measure ourselves against those characters and the characteristics that effectively place us in the story, and then ask ourselves, have we allowed ourselves to be comfortable with the world around us? Have we allowed it to have an impact on us? Have we absorbed some of the slang that goes with this world instead of holding ourselves to a higher standard? Have we become a little brainwashed to the music, the entertainment, the politics of the world around us? Or are we quick to slam the door and embrace what God says is right and keep ourselves unsoiled by that? We can see in the story of Daniel and his friends that there comes a point where God's servants are unwilling to relinquish their hold on the truth as it has been taught to them in their earlier years. We can pick up the next step in the story in verses 5 and 8. Daniel chapter 1 and verse 5. It says that the king assigned them a daily portion of the rich food which the king ate and of the wine which he drank. You know, when we get a chance to go to the feast, we save all our tithes and we get to go to nicer restaurants than we can appreciate during the normal part of our lives, the other 51 weeks. Or you know, on the holy days, even if it's not the Feast of Tabernacles, we have the opportunity to go out to dinner and enjoy some of the finer things. All of these were put before them, and it would have been at the ultimate that culture could provide. So whatever we can enjoy, it's multiple of that. And we have to recognize this is what they were exposed to. But verse 8, it says, but Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself. So Daniel saw this as a step over the line. By doing this, I will defile myself. I will give up my character and my teaching and my understanding and my beliefs if I do this. It says Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the royal rations of food and wine. The commentary says it's generally accepted that the chief reasons why Daniel would not eat meat from the royal table were probably, one, that they ate unclean beasts that were forbidden by Jewish law. So, you know, all the finest, richest foods that would have been there. Daniel recognized that God says no to this, yes to this. And so if that's put in front of me, no, I'm not giving up the character because you see that as cool or you see that as rich. Or secondly, it says because the animals that were eaten were first offered as sacrificial victims to the Babylonian gods, which was another part of the culture, which says, no, I will not partake of that. What did God say as his people would go into the land? He said, don't partake of their gods. Don't partake of their culture. Because very soon you'll find need to say, you know, don't partake of the wives and such, because the culture is going to be thrown in your face each and every day. And it's so easy for human beings to say, well, all right, well, I'll compromise on this little point over here. And compromise becomes that slippery slope to meeting in the middle, which means you're really not a member of either part. It's interesting to notice that the word here used in verse 8 is the word resolve. The word presents the picture that an individual, again, has backbone, that they have a moral compass that holds them on target and helps them not to wander or waver in their journey. The King James Version says that Daniel was purposed. He had purpose. He had strength. He had a commitment to do. It says that he would not defile himself. He was purposed. The Living Version paraphrase says that he made up his mind. So at that point, he put his foot down. He drew that line in the sand and said, I will not go this far. We see here that Daniel's character stands up to their program. They've touched on a nerve at Daniel's core. They've gotten down to the point where it's important to him, and he won't go any further. Again, we've described Daniel as a spiritual survivor, as a godly man in an ungodly world. And at this point, we see him dig in. Daniel might be a prisoner. You know, he wasn't in chains, but he was a prisoner. He recognized that he was in that position, but he wasn't going to let go of God's law.
You and I are confronted with issues each day that we need to evaluate, and sometimes they're minor. They're issues of style. What we wear or how our nameplate is inscribed was not a major issue. But simply knowing what's right, simply wanting to do what's right, is not enough. That true backbone, that true character means that that temptation to participate is denied. So Daniel spoke up, and God gave Daniel favor in the eyes of his keeper, and God will do that for us today in our lives as well when we do that, when we show that character, when we show that strength. In verses 11 through 14, we see that David offered a reasonable alternative and respectfully asked for some time for the option to play out. The story shown for us here is that Daniel was a man of purpose. He was a man of strength. He was a man of resolve. And yet, what's interesting to watch, we can just roll forward with that as our primary thought, but we also need to recognize, you know, peripherally, we have to see that Daniel was also a man of diplomacy. He was a young man who showed wisdom, because he didn't step up and throw that tantrum. He didn't beat his chest and slam the door in this guy's face. He approached a man who had the authority, the position to make his life very difficult. And yet what he did was he prayed to God and he said, "Father, I'm not willing to go here. And you know why. And so I'm asking you to help me formulate the right alternative in my mind and then to communicate it in a way in which it will find favor." And so, brethren, there are those of us that have had to go to work and say, I know you're taking year-end inventory and you're taking it on Saturday. I can't be there because of. And yet, and so you don't just do that and slap them across the face. And yet, I can come in on Sunday and I can take care of all the paperwork so that your team that takes the counts can go home 2 hours earlier. I'll work for straight time on Sunday, so that you don't have to pay that 8 hours of overtime on Saturday. How's that work for you? Suddenly what you've used is some tact, some diplomacy, some wisdom, and you've recognized what their value system is, and you haven't given up your own, but you've tapped into theirs. And now what you're doing is you're turning the table. Instead of them being the burden to unweight what you want to do, you've hinged things back and you leveraged things back in your favor. And now somebody's saying, "Well, wait a minute, I like the sound of that. That's a pretty good idea. You know, that guy's pretty smart over there. You know, he saved us, and that's going to make up." So what we can do by really thinking and praying and watching what the balance is, we can turn things in our favor. Or God can turn things in our favor when we work with him and through him. And that's what we saw Daniel do. He didn't lose track of his manners. He didn't pound his chest in defiance and berate this authority figure that could have made his life difficult. Instead, he depended on God and his wits to allow him to do the right thing. Brethren, again, that needs to be our focus as we go through our lives. Our road may be different or seem different than the life of Daniel. Our challenges may not rise to the scope of Daniel's. And yet our end destination is the same. And so when we look at that and we hold Scripture up to be our mirror and our measuring post, we need to live the life according to that so that we can end up in the same destination. Let's look at one more trial that Daniel faces in chapter 6 as we wrap up the story of this spiritual survivor, this godly man in an ungodly society. At the point that we get to chapter 6, we see in Daniel's life that he's been serving quite successfully for some time, and God has continued to bless him, and we know that things were going pretty good. As I mentioned earlier, when life was good for Daniel, life was really pretty smooth. And yet, with a little political coup going on here, we pick it up in verse number 4 of Daniel 6, we see that life is going to get challenging once again. Daniel chapter 6 and verse 4. Again, remember, we're asking the question, do we have the strength of character, the strength in our backbone to stand in the face of pressure? And will the world around us recognize that when push comes to shove, as Louis Degas said of Papillon, temptation resisted is a true measure of character? Will they be inspired by what we're capable of doing in the face of the world around us? Daniel chapter 6 and verse 4, it says, "So the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom." We have a jealous bunch of little politicians here, and they're looking for cause against Daniel. "But they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him." Then these men said, "We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." So they first looked to the daily physical things that they were a part of. Can we dig up some dirty laundry here? The commentary says they found no blemish in his administration. And you know, they looked long and hard. They went in with their forensic auditors and they looked to find the littlest things that they could blow up to make obvious to the king that he's skimming some off the top. You know, is he building a real nice house over here in the corner of the kingdom with the gold that he's skimming off each day? But the commentary goes on to say, but he was faithful to the king. But he was also faithful to God, and this they hoped to construe into a crime and make it the cause of his ruin. They couldn't find a chink in Daniel's armor, but by sucking up to the king and creating something, they tricked the king into proclaiming that only he could be worshipped for 30 days under penalty of death. And so the law got written, and suddenly Daniel found himself in a real pickle. You know, the God that Daniel had grown up to know as a boy, that he had studied in Jerusalem, whose name was tied to him through his own name, who had delivered him and blessed him in this strange land all these years, was now off limits because of some little underhanded political scheme. So what do we do if we're Daniel? You know, brethren, we know that we can come before God in prayer anytime. You know, when we're driving down the street and we see, you know, a beautiful bank of flowers along the side of the freeway, we can come to God in praise and honor and thank him for the creation that he has. When a thunderstorm goes by and the road gets a little slick and we can feel the car move a little bit, we can thank God for the angels that are sitting on our bumpers keeping us on that pavement. When somebody cuts us off in that same car, we can thank God for giving us the distance or the reaction time or the patience not to step on the gas instead of step on the brake. We can come before God in every moment in prayer. And so Daniel could have, as he lived his life for this next 30 days, he could have chosen to say, "You know what, Father? I'm not going to lose touch with you. But out of penalty of death, I'm just going to walk the roads of Babylon here, and I'm going to pray to you in private. And when these 30 days are done, you know, I will have survived." He could have done that. Or he could have ridden off into the countryside and found a thicket somewhere where he could kneel down and pray out of the eyesight of everybody else. But was that the strength of backbone that Daniel had? For 30 days, does he stop and hope that God will understand? I mean, it is a matter of life and death. Let's look at it in verse 10. Let's answer that question. Because this is where things get exciting. This is where things get inspiring. When we look at something and say, you know, what are we capable of? What are we willing to stand up to? Look at a man here that faced death in the jaws of the big cats. And how did he react? Verse number 10. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, we need to break this verse down step by step. When Daniel knew that the writing was signed, so, you know, he wasn't oblivious. He didn't go his way and do something by accident. He full knew this. I mean, he operated in the king's palace at the throne. And so he knew everything that was going on. When he knew that the writing was signed, he went home. Did he go home to hide? Did he go home to cry? No. And in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day. That day, you know, did he, well, you know, just kind of lay low for a couple of days here, for a couple of weeks here, for 30 days here. It says that day three times and prayed and gave thanks before God as was his custom since early days. Daniel, when he was old enough to understand, was conditioned by his parents. Daniel, when he was old enough to study, understood the culture and the background and the holy days and tithing and the teachings of the heroes of the Bible. Since his early days, Daniel doesn't shrink and hide. He doesn't go pray in a cave somewhere. He knew that the decree had gone out, and he knew that it was written for him. They might as well just have put his name across the top of it. And he knew that the penalty for defying it was death. And knowing all that, knowing that the lion's den might be his end result, literally that day, if and when he were caught, Daniel still felt that it was important to maintain his regular contact with God. Think about that. We're told that no greater love has a man for a friend than he lay down his life. And here Daniel was willing to lay down his life for his God and for his practice that tied him to God. Remember what we read in Psalm chapter 34 and verse 17, because Daniel certainly knew the truth that was found in this particular statement. Psalm chapter 34, 17 says, "The righteous cry out, and the Lord hears, and he delivers them from all their troubles." He provides us that easy button in our lives. And it won't always be that we're suddenly just zapped to another place and we're suddenly sitting on a lawn chair safe, but there is a way out. There will be relief. There will be deliverance from those situations. And it may not be today. Daniel ultimately he was not an invisible man for those 30 days. He got caught, he faced the issues, but God saw him and delivered him out of all those trials. Daniel was a godly man in an ungodly world, and God heard Daniel's prayers and delivered him out of the mouth of those hungry lions. Daniel's story has been told over and over again, and there are no new facets to be found here. But as I said from the sermonette, sometimes when we see it a little different, when we focus on a different word, we understand it with greater clarity. And we ask ourselves, when we look at one of these heroes like this, Daniel resisted the temptation to cave into the pressure, to compromise, to meet them in the middle somewhere. He stood his ground, and he was willing to take whatever came. Do we have that strength of character, that strength of backbone, when we face the things that we face each day? The minor things, the more significant things, whatever it is, whatever you've faced in your life up until now and what you'll face in the future, what each of us will ultimately face in the future. The story of Daniel is a treasure that we should read and reread and then hold ourselves up against, as we should against each and every one of the scriptures that we read. The rest of the Papillon movie shows the indomitable will of a man that wanted to be free. He escaped only to be caught again and punished even more severely, but the system was never able to break Henri. After 5 more years of solitary confinement, and now gray-haired and hunched-shouldered, Papillon still yearns for freedom. And when he's released, he's moved to a different island as a prison. And from a high cliff on his island prison, still yearning to be free, he watches the ocean below him, and he comes to realize that every 7th wave that comes into this deadly cove that he lives on, every 7th wave is strong enough to come back off that wall and carry things out to sea. He's been testing this by throwing coconuts off the cave or off the cliff, and he watches them get smashed against. But every 7th one, he has come to find, is strong enough as it comes off, the thing thrown at the right time will be washed out to sea. He was never willing to be broken by, enveloped by, taken over, or give in to the system around him. That's a human nature, character that was very strong in him. Brethren, we have to find the way to escape each and every day in little ways, to be free of the world around us as we continue to walk down the path toward God's kingdom. Again, we know that the story of Papillon was based on a true story, and so what we come to find out is that Papillon then created for himself a little raft, something to float his way to freedom. And counting, after saying goodbye to his friend Louis Degas, who is also on this same island, as they've grown old and they get a little less worried about them trying to escape, they relegate them to this easier island, if you will, but nobody has ever escaped from it. And his friend Louis Degas is there with them, and they spend some time together as he finds his way for freedom, but he can't talk Louis into leaving. Louis has been broken by being caught. And so as that 7th wave comes in and starts to move its way out, he throws his raft off the edge of the cliff, and he hurls himself, I don't know, it looks like 100 feet when you see it in the movie, and he clambers across this little raft, and he's taken out to sea, away from the prison that this life has taken him to. And the film ends with a narration that Papillon lived the rest of his life in freedom, based on a true story, the autobiography of Henri Carrier. Brethren, as we face the challenges of our daily lives, we all know that we need to keep up our guard. We know that we need to insulate ourselves and distance ourselves from this world, sometimes physically, always spiritually, and maintain that good, strong, godly character. The pressure to conform, the pressure to participate, the pressure to lower our standards is something we're constantly confronted by. God invites his family to join him as family members, or invites us to join him as family members, but he has set some very high standards. And he will not abide with sin, and therefore we cannot dabble in the practices of this world around us. We can't dance at the edge of the fire all the time and expect God to pluck us back when danger really arises. Remember that Psalm 34, chapter 17 says, "The righteous cry out, and God hears." Not those that claim membership, because there's an awful lot that do. As my children and I were riding up here today, my son likes Stephen Curtis Chapman. He's a Christian singer, and he's got some real catchy music. And I pointed out a number of times that much of it is true. Much of it is appropriate. Much of it is scriptural. But Satan still twists that way to say, I believe in you. But do you see it? Is the strength of his backbone living each day according to the words that he puts out there to the world? We need to know what's right and what's wrong. And when Satan mixes them and puts them in front of us, well, are we willing to, because most of it's right, are we willing to participate? Right is right, wrong is wrong. God's word, his commandment, is not arbitrary. And so we need to be able and willing to slice it and dissect those parts that are improper when we see them. But we've got to know them for what they are before we can do that. Turn with me to Psalm chapter 1 and verse 1. How, brethren, do we stay clean in an environment gone bad? Again, there is some real beauty in this world around us. But in the situations when we do face challenges to our character and to the truth and the way of life we know we ought to live, how do we stay clean? Verse 1 of Psalm 1, it says, "Blessed is the man who has not walked in the counsel of the ungodly." Remember we read earlier, I believe, in Ephesians and in Proverbs, where it says, when they entice you, when they invite you, when they lure you, don't go there. "Blessed is the man who has not walked in the counsel of the ungodly." So he's not spent time among them. "He has not stood in the way of the sinners." And remember, when we read this verse, we recognize this is a progression of, well, I'll listen, and pretty soon I kind of spend time. You know, I walk, I stand with them. And thirdly, "who has not sat in the seat of the scornful." I haven't pulled up a seat and gotten comfortable and put a more permanent presence here with those people. Verse 2, "but his delight is only in the law of God, and in his law he meditates day and night." The early scripture said to fear God always. Verse 3, "and all which he does shall be blessed." There is the promise. And when it says all, again, it's talking where it said, finally, brethren, not every, but in the greater scheme, in the summary of the whole, finally, that which he does shall be blessed. Brethren, like Papillon, let's never lose our desire for freedom. Let's not get comfortable or give up on that goal that only God's way of life provides. John chapter 8 and verse 32 says, "And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." The truth for Papillon was that he needed that seventh wave. For us, brethren, there's lots of little pieces that are truth. And each one of those needs to be held up and used as a filter when an opportunity is presented to us that we go, no, the truth says that's not right. I straighten my spine and don't go there. Because temptation resisted. The ways of this world refuse are the true measure of our character. Let's maintain that strong measure of character and cling to God's unwavering love as Papillon clung to the raft that carried him to safety and freedom.